As it turned out, Linda Randall had a darn good reason for skipping out on our appointment Saturday night. Linda Randall was dead. I sneezed as I ducked under the yellow police tape in the sweatpants and t-shirt I had been allowed to pluck from the mess of my place before the police car had brought me across town to Linda Randall's apartment, and cowboy boots. Mister had dragged one of my sneakers off, and I hadn't had time to find it, so I wore what I had. Freaking cat. Linda had died a bit earlier that evening. After getting to the scene, Murphy had tried to phone me, failed to get through, and then sent a squad car down to pick me up and bring me in to do my consulting bit. The dutiful patrolman sent to collect me had stopped to check out the crazy naked guy a block away from my apartment and had been surprised and more than a little suspicious when I turned out to be the very same man they were supposed to pick up and bring to the crime scene. Dear Susan had come to my rescue, explaining away what had happened as just one of those things, tee-hee, and assuring the officers that she was all right and would be fine to drive home. She got a little pale around the edges when she saw once more the ruins of my apartment and the enormous dent the demon had put on the side of her car, but she made a bold face of it and eventually left the scene with that, "I've got a story to write," gleam in her eye. She stopped and gave me a kiss on the cheek on her way out and whispered, "Not bad, Harry," in my ear. Then she patted my bare ass and got in her car. I blushed. I don't think the cops noticed it, in the rain, in the dark. The patrolmen looked at me askance, but were more than happy to let me put on some fresh clothes. The only things I had clean were more sweats and another t-shirt, this one proclaiming in bold letters over a little cartoon graveyard, "Easter has been canceled. They found the body." I put those on, and my duster, which had somehow survived the demon attack, and my utterly inappropriate cowboy boots. And then I had gotten into the patrol car and been driving across town. I clipped my little ID card to my coat's lapel and followed the uniforms in. One of them led me to Murphy. On the way, I took in the details. There were a lot of people standing around gawking. It was still fairly early, after all. The rain came down in a fine mist and softened the contours of the scene. There were several police cars parked in the apartment building's parking lots, and one on the lawn by the door leading out to the little concrete patio from the apartment in question. Someone had left his bulbs on. The blue lights flashed over the scene in alternating swathes of shadow and cold light. There was a lot of yellow police tape around. And right in the middle of it all was Murphy. She looked terrible, like she hadn't eaten anything that didn't come out of a vending machine or drunk anything but stale coffee since I had seen her last. Her blue eyes were tired and bloodshot, but still sharp. "Dresden," she said. She peered up at me. "You planning on having King Kong climb your hair?" I tried to smile at her. "Yeah, we still need to cast our screaming damsel. Interested?" Murphy snorted. She snorts really well for someone with such a cute nose. "Come on." She spun on one heel and walked up to the apartment, as though she wasn't exhausted and at the end of her rope. The forensic team was already there, so we got some nifty plastic booties to put on over our shoes and loose plastic gloves for our hands from an officer standing beside the door. "I tried to call earlier," Murphy said, "but your phone was out of service. Again, Harry." "Bad night for it," I responded, wobbling as I slipped the booties on. "What's the story?" "Another victim," she said. "Same M.O. as Tommy Tom and the Stanton woman." "Jesus," I said. "They're using the storms." "What?" Murphy turned and fixed her eyes on me. "The storm," I repeated. "You can tap storms and other natural phenomena to get things done. All natural fuel for the mojo." "You didn't say anything about that before," Murphy accused. "I hadn't thought of it until tonight." I rubbed my face. It made sense. Hell's bells. That was how the Shadow Man had been able to do all of that in one night. He'd called the demon and been able to send it after me, as well as appearing in the shadow he'd projected. And he'd been able to kill again. "Have you got an ID on the victim?" I asked. Murphy turned to go inside as she answered. "Linda Randall, chauffeur, age 29. It was a good thing Murphy had turned away, or the way my jaw dropped would have told her I knew the deceased, and she would have had all sorts of uncomfortable questions. I stared at Murphy for a second, then hurriedly veiled my expression and followed her inside the apartment. Linda Randall's one-bedroom apartment looked like the trailer of a rock band that did little besides play concerts, host parties, and fall into a stupor afterwards. Dirty clothes were strewn on one side of a king-sized bed. There was a disproportionate amount of clothing that looked as though it had been purchased from a Fredericks of Hollywood catalog, lacy and silky and satiny colors, all bright, designed to attract the eye. There were many candles around the bed, on shelves and dressers and a night table, most burned halfway down. The drawer of the night table was partly open, revealing a number of personal amusements. Linda Randall had, apparently, liked her toys. The kitchenette, off to one side, looked largely unused, except for the coffee pot, the microwave, and the trash can, in which several pizza boxes were crammed. Maybe it was the pizza boxes that did it. Gave me a sudden pang of understanding, empathy for Linda. My own kitchen looked the same a lot of the time, minus the microwave. Here lived someone else who knew what it was to know that the only thing waiting home was a sense of loneliness. Sometimes it's comforting. Most often it isn't. I'll bet Linda would have understood that. But I'd never have a chance to know. The forensics team was gathered around the bed, concealing whatever was there like a cluster of buzzards around the exposed head of the outlaws they used to bury up to their necks in the Old West. They spoke among themselves in low, calm voices, dispassionate as skilled dinner chatter, calling little details to the attention of their companions, complimenting one another on their observations. "Harry," Murphy said quietly, her tone of voice suggesting that it wasn't the first time she said it. "Are you sure you're all right for this?" My mouth twitched. Of course I wasn't all right for this. No one should ever be all right for this sort of thing. But instead of saying that, I told her, "My head's just aching. Sorry. Let's just get it over with." She nodded and led me over toward the bed. Murphy was a lot shorter than most of the men and women working around the bed, but I had almost a head of height on all of them, so I didn't have to ask anyone to move. Just stepped up close to the bed and looked. Linda had been on the phone when she died. She was naked. Even this early in the year, she had tan lines around her hips. She must have gone to a tanning booth during the winter. Her hair was still damp. She lay on her back, her eyes half closed, her expression tranquil, as it hadn't been any time I'd seen her. Her heart had been torn out. It was laying on the king-sized bed about a foot and a half from her, pulped and squashed and slippery, sort of a scarlet and gray color. There was a hole in her chest, too, showing where the bone had been splintered, outward by the force that had removed her heart. I just stared a few moments, noting the details in a sort of a detached way. Again. Again, someone had used magic to end a life. I had to think of her as she sounded on the phone, joking, a quick wit, a sort of sly sensuality in the way she said her words and phrased her sentences, a little hint of insecurity around the edges, vulnerability that magnified the other parts of her personality. Her hair was damp because she'd been taking a bath before she came to see me. Whatever anyone said of her, she had been passionately, vitally alive. Had been. Eventually, I realized how quiet the room was. The men and women of the forensics team, all five of them, were looking up at me, waiting. As I looked down, they all averted their gazes, but you didn't have to be a wizard to see what was in their faces. Fear, pure and simple. They had been faced with something science couldn't explain. It rattled them, shook them to their cores, the sudden, violent, and bloody evidence that 300 years of science and research was no match for the things that were still, even after all this time, lurking in the dark. And I was the one who was supposed to have the answers. I didn't have any for them, and I felt like a shit for remaining silent as I stepped back and turned away from Linda's body, then walked across the room to the small bathroom. The tub was still full of water. A bracelet and earrings were laid out on a counter in front of a mirror, plus a little makeup, a bottle of perfume. Murphy appeared beside me and stood with me, looking at the bathroom. She seemed a lot smaller than she usually does. "She called us," Murphy said. 911 has a call recorded. That's how we knew to come here. She called and said that she knew who had killed Jennifer Stanton and Tommy Tom, and now they were coming for her. Then she started screaming. That's when the spell hit her. The phone probably went dead right after. Murphy frowned up at me and nodded. "Yeah, it did. But it was working fine when we got here. Magic disrupts technology sometimes, you know that." I rubbed one eye. "Have you talked to any relatives, anything like that?" Murphy shook her head. "There aren't any relatives in town. We're looking now, but it might take some time. We tried to reach her boss, but he wasn't available. Mr. Beckett?" She studied my face, waiting for me to say something. "You ever heard of him?" she asked after a moment. I didn't look back at Murphy. I shrugged. Murphy's jaw tensed, little motions at the corners of her face. Then she said, "Greg and Helen Beckett." 3 years ago, their daughter Amanda was killed in a crossfire. Johnny Marconi's thugs were shooting it out with some of the Jamaican gang that was trying to muscle in on the territory back then. One of them shot the little girl. She lived for 3 weeks in intensive care and died when they took her off life support. I didn't say anything, but I thought of Mrs. Beckett's numb face and dead eyes. The Becketts attempted to lodge a wrongful death suit against Johnny Marconi, but Marconi's lawyers were too good. They got it thrown out before it even went to court. And they never found the man who shot the little girl. Word has it that Marconi offered to pay them blood money, make reparation, but they turned it down. I didn't say anything.